I can go first. Okay. I feel like I don't that much, or at least you all gaslight me into telling me that
I've done. I've done. No,
you have. Me. You have so much, so you should go first.
Physician, you have gaslit yourself. Yes,
I was. Last night, Rich is in DC. I went home and I turned the lamp lights down, and I came back. And I was like, "Wait a minute! Why are these lights so low?"
Just and this is the quickest thing. One of my coworkers used the term gaslighting, but I think he used it wrong. So I was like, "I'm sorry. What do you mean by that?" And he's like, "You know, when you turn like a gas stove and it lights." I'm like.
So wait, what does he think? Like, how did he use it?
He thinks it means to like provoke something, like as in there's gasoline.
And now it's like more. Yeah,
you're kicking up the heat. Right. Where I was like,
knows, I would imagine. Here's the thing. I get misusing the word gaslight and not knowing what gaslight, like I imagine losing the movie connection.
Sure.
Yeah, of course.
I still think it's very easy to say like, well, I don't really know how, I'm just looking at how people use it.
Right.
And I'm misinterpreting how they're using it. But I love that you had to ask him what he thought it meant. He was like, it's just like when people turn a gas stove.
Turn on a stove.
Yeah, like light it up. I was like, I don't, okay.
That is funny. It's kind of like an egg corn, but not really.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
With, yeah, sans the mispronunciation aspect, just like the misunderstanding. Right, like creating word. Your own idea as to like what this word must refer to.
Like you hear it and you just assume
it's like, oh, right, like, so like
means,
on the stove.
That
yeah.
means to light the gas.
Right, to like turn the gas light up higher on your stove, of course.
At one point, well, I tried to explain it and I was like, no, I think it means to actually, you know, it's like turning a gas light on. He's like, yeah, to light the gas. I'm like, this isn't worth it.
The podcast where three friends sit down with a troubled movie, share a nice cocktail, talk about what was good, what was bad, and how we could all do it so much better. I am your host for this week, Lee, witness my matted chest hair, Delahanty.
I am Chris, the Milky Way Man, Ravel.
And I am Brendan, Dear John Daddy Drishler.
And if you could not tell from those nicknames, we have just watched the movie Addicted to Love from some year.
1997. Directed by Griffin Dunn, who you may more know as an actor, but he does direct some things,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, a handful of things.
Starring Meg Ryan, Matthew Broderick. Oh, Checky Caro, is that how we think it is?
Checky Caro. Or
Checky
like
Caro, yeah, sorry.
Best
sorry,
guess.
Checky. And Kelly Preston, and that's pretty much mostly it, really. Yeah, that's when it was. Maureen Stapleton, I guess, as Nana, apparently, too, deserves a mentioning.
Yep.
Even though she's in and out. In
and out in one scene, like
5 minutes.
Two superfluous scenes that could have easily been trimmed.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Close to a tight 90. Close, you know, nearly there.
Yeah.
Which is a
100
good,
minutes, so
we've
pretty
done
close.
Pretty well so far.
Yeah.
Not the least of which, because we've done, I think, a fair share of rom-coms,
right? Which, thank God, by and large, at least at that point, tended to be 90 to 100 minutes.
Yeah.
It was time to have been alive.
In any event, tight 90 or no tight 90, we did need a little libation to help us get through this movie. What did we drink this time?
The drink that we made was called Mutual Drinking Activity. It was 1/2 ounce of Saint Germain, 4 ounces of Prosecco, sparkling water, mint, and strawberries. You muddle one strawberry with some mint sprigs and Saint Germain in a shaker, shake it with ice, and strain into a wine glass. Add the Prosecco atop with sparkling water, and stir gently to combine, garnishing with a mint sprig and a strawberry.
Yum.
Yum. I agree. I wish it was as springy outside as that drink seemed to be, because it is cold and wet.
It's,
but like,
it's a very having brunch al fresco, you know, like out on the terrace kind of drink.
Yeah, no, it was nice. It was light. It was just fruity enough without being saccharine and just floral enough without being perfumey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I liked this a lot. This worked for me.
Parfait.
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 Oui. Sorry, what are you saying? Why are you saying parfait?
Yeah.
Because that's French for perfect.
I thought you wanted parfait.
Well, I always want parfait.
Maman, parfait!
You know, growing up in the French countryside.
In the French Riviera.
Is that actually French for perfect, or are you just saying perfect in a weird way?
No, it's true.
So the
dessert is called
cuisine
perfect.
Is called perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
because the French are a boring and unimaginative plot.
Yeah. What do you want to call this? Parfait.
It is perfection. This amount of fruit and cream and cakes is perfect. What could possibly be better than this?
Okay. Well, it was a good drink.
It was great, yeah.
Oui, oui.
I want to say, like, would very good be, like...
Très bien.
Très bien, or, like...
Oui.
It would be très bien. Très bon. I took 2 weeks of Duolingo French to prepare me to go to Quebec.
How'd that work for you?
Really bad.
Yeah. More work than I did when I went to Quebec.
Yeah, off topic, but well, the drink was good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A good time
was had by all.
The mint and the strawberry was a nice...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was. Yeah, we all enjoyed it as we watched this movie projected on the wall from a camera obscura that we had pointed at the neighbors who were watching Addicted to Love.
Occasionally one of us had to get over and kind of crank it in different directions.
As the monitors changed, we had to do it. And then occasionally we couldn't hear it, so we would just make up our own dialogue too. It was fun. We started to bond.
Okay.
Anyway, Addicted to Love. I've got the synopsis for it right here.
I'm trying to seg into it multiple times.
Yes, I know you are. And I'm resisting all temptation. The story begins in a small town where Sam works as an astronomer and enjoys an idyllic life with his childhood sweetheart, Linda, who is a school teacher. She wants more experiences than can be offered there. Like Belle, she wants so much more than this provincial life. So she goes to New York City for a 2-month teaching fellowship. Okay. Instead of returning home, Linda sends Sam a Dear John letter from her father announcing that she is staying in New York. He leaves almost immediately for the city, convinced he can get her back. Sam quickly discovers Linda's living with a new lover, French restaurant owner Anton. Sam breaks into an abandoned building from across Anton's residence and converts his astronomy equipment to surveillance equipment. He sets up house and a camera obscura, watching her interactions with Anton in hopes of finding out more information about them, as well as predicting when they will break up using his scientific methods. Sam's surveillance operation is later discovered by Maggie, a photographer and motorcyclist, determined to get revenge on Anton, her ex-fiancé. She sets up in a nearby room and soon has sound equipment set up to eavesdrop on the couple. Out of money and to find out more about him, Sam takes a job at Anton's restaurant as a dishwasher. As the men talk, they become friends, Anton unaware of Sam's connection to Linda. Partnering with Maggie in the hopes of driving them apart, a comedy of errors ensues, in which Maggie and Sam try unethical and nasty tricks to break apart their respective former partners, including, identity theft, assault, embarrassing in public with a street performer's monkey, paying children to spray him with a woman's perfume in the street, planting woman's underwear and receipts for expensive gifts, and getting Anton's restaurant shut down by bringing in cockroaches on a busy night with a food critic there. All the bases are covered. Mutually hostile at first, Sam and Maggie eventually warm up to each other in their quest to break up Linda and Anton, complicating their original mission to win their former partners back. I want to note real quick here, Maggie very explicitly says she does not want to win Anton back. She wants to ruin his life. I just want to throw that out there.
She's like, I hate him.
Yeah, Maggie does not want him back. She just wants him miserable. When Maggie's Nan visits, she insists that they kiss for a photo. She believes he is her fiance. And they obviously share a moment. But suddenly they discover Linda has left Anton. He really had slept with another woman. Someone in the bank to help him with a loan. Maggie pushes Sam out as Linda is now gone, and he runs into a desolate Anton, who talks him into joining him in his place. Maggie watches as they interact. The next day, she's there to spy on Sam when he sees and kisses Linda, and again spies on him that night as he helps a severely injured Anton. He unintentionally got put into an upper body cast. This feels sort of like it's written by the aliens from Arrival, where the sense is not following.
We're kind of like going
in a circle and then backward in time.
Yeah.
Yes. Sam mentions Linda, which makes Anton realize something's fishy about Sam, and Anton attacks him. The upshot of it all is Maggie makes peace with Anton, Sam comes clean with Linda, and in the closing, there are two couples, Sam and Maggie, and Anton and Linda.
I like that you read that like you were having a conversation with yourself.
Right.
There was like a bit
There was a lot of rise and fall there.
You were like, this happened, and then that happened. Well,
you gotta keep these stories fresh and interesting, my friends.
It was like you were doing a one man play.
My one man show is just going to be me reading movie synopses on Wikipedia.
Yeah, but like with like verve,
with intonation, you know, with acting.
I seem like a lot of people make fun of one man shows, but are one man shows ever good?
I think it really just depends on like the subject and the talent, you know?
It's challenging, right? Because if that person made a mistake and they shouldn't be having a one-man show, it'll probably be pretty big.
You are in for an unfun night.
You can't hide behind anyone else's performance. It's on you, baby.
No. You just have to feign a heart attack and get out of there.
Exactly.
That's what I do.
And it's what I would do. Anywho.
Yeah, so that's the movie.
Might as well face it. They're addicted to love.
Does
that phrase ever come up in the movie?
No, it's just the song.
They do play the song.
Yeah, they play a cover of the song over the end credits.
So, like, our title's not sort of like copyrighted in the same way, so you can call a movie in reference to a song?
I think you can, and it doesn't matter. As long as you don't play this, if you play the song, then you have to worry about getting rights to the song.
Because they're clearly trying to evoke the song.
Yeah, no, agreed.
And then they had to get a cover because they can't afford the real
song. Right, I mean, it almost feels like it's one of those things where, like, they didn't have a title for this movie, or they had a generic title, and some studio exec was like, but you know, like,
what?
Addicted to Love, and we could get a cover of the song to play.
What a time. one, that was sort of like the one of the ways execs could harm movies the most, was just like force a stupid title. Yes. And not just like sort of dictate in a whole entire batshit direction.
Right, yeah. The most you could be is like, what if your title is dumber?
Yeah. What if we gave your movie a really bad title and you had to have a goofy tagline for your like, hard-hitting Oscar bait drama?
Yes.
Anyway, let's open up the discussion by the...
There's something I want to throw out real quick about like the poster. Did you see the poster for this?
You talked about it. Was I not in the room, or was I walking in and you were talking about it?
You might have been, because it reminds me so much of like the Three to Tango poster, where it's just the four of them, and they're all sort of like kissy and dewy, and it's their foreheads all close to each other. Right, and they all look sort of like happy and pleasant. So this is, again, a poster similar to Three to Tango, where it feels like it's for a much more conventional rom-com sort of movie, but in actuality, it is ostensibly a dark comedy with two of those characters trying to destroy like the lives of a third character in there.
Yeah, like one of them is definitely trying to destroy life. He just wants...
Right, he's going along with it because he wants his girlfriend back.
Yeah.
And that fourth character, his girlfriend, is almost not a character because she doesn't really have a personality except she makes her dad do her dirty work for her.
I mean, if she has a character, it's repugnant because she's strung along by any man that she...
It almost seems like her personality type is she imprints on whatever man is there and then takes on aspects of their personality.
And then also sort of like... doesn't just sort of brushes off any harm she causes and isn't so responsible for it.
Yeah.
So she's not doesn't come off looking great.
No, certainly not.
But yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
So obviously like the movie we get is really like at odds with like what
the
I
intention.
Think it's trying to be.
Yes.
Yeah, what it was maybe written to be or intended to be and how it comes out on the screen. Not always match. There's a lot of like disparity in the tone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've seen people online just in reviews of reading this where some people really seem to be approaching this as though it is a straight up rom-com where characters are doing skeezy things and they're kind of like, how does the movie not realize that these characters are gross? And like, I 100% think the movie knows these characters are gross and they're doing gross things and this is supposed to be more of a black comedy. It's just not told effectively.
Well, I don't know. I do think that it's, I don't know where this choice came in. Maybe this is another studio choice, another exact choice. But like for the two characters who are doing stalking and blacks and blackmailing and scheming to like
fall in love. Yeah, no, that's certainly true.
Is like a bananas choice that really models the black comedy.
Right.
Aspect.
Because then at the end you're supposed to be like they do belong together.
And
it's like
to feel good
I don't
about
think
that.
So. Yeah.
And there is a turn at some point where we're supposed to start rooting for them getting together.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's also one of those weird things too where when they're getting together at the end, the dialogue is playing it as though it's a joke because it's Matthew Broderick who shows up and is like, I just saw a movie on the airplane about Lassie and Timmy, and Lassie killed a man and they had to be sent away. And Timmy's like, no, I'm going to white fang you, girl. Get out of here. And then it gets to the scene where Meg Ryan says, like, and at the end, like, did Lassie come back? And he's like, yeah, Lassie came back. And she's like, and did Lassie fuck Timmy? And Matthew Broderick's like, yeah, they did. And it's just sort of like, this is clearly supposed to be a joke. Like, I get it that this is supposed to be a joke based on, like, some, you know, them taking the story of Timmy and Lassie and like planting their own thoughts and desires onto it. But because it's played so straight and because like everything about it feels so conventional rom-com from them getting back together at the end, it's just sort of a moment of watching them being like, did Timmy like get with Lassie? Like, what are you talking about?
Between all of that and just how like misleading the poster is, it kind of leads me to believe maybe this movie was like marketed in entirely the wrong way, which could also contribute to people having a very confused reception of the movie, right? Because maybe with all that framing you do think, I'm sorry, does this movie realize what it is really? That is super weird. And yeah, I definitely think them getting together makes you think like, oh, was that what this was all about really?
I'm not saying I disagree with the idea that you're saying where like the movie knows that this is a black comedy. I don't think that, like, marketing knew that.
I agree.
That, like, I don't even think that it was supposed to be... I mean, I don't think audiences can really piece that together.
Right? No, I agree.
It's easier to watch this and because it looks like one and you're like,
right.
Oh, it must be
rom-com. Because it starts off as, like, a fairly conventional sort of rom-com and then it, like, devolves as Matthew Broderick's, like, psyche starts to fracture.
Yeah.
But... I this is one of those things that I almost wish we had seen the trailer for this movie just to be like, what did the trailer present this movie as? Like, how is the trailer interpreting this movie? Because it would be really interesting to see if marketing's take on this movie
ended
up being.
We gotta have these thoughts pre-recorded.
I know. I wish I had. My own dumb fault.
There's other ways in which I feel like the tone is at odds where it's like, the way, if it's a black comedy, there's this turn that comes at the end where they do manage to like exceed above and beyond expectations of destroying
Anton's life.
Anton's life.
Shoots the moon, even.
Like, Anton is painted as a pretty horrible person. However, he also has the most, like, authentic, like, low point human breakdown.
He plays it very straight and realistic.
And it's like, this is not a black comedy depiction of, like, a man getting comeuppance. This is just making me feel like, wow, these guys are pieces.
Even at the end, whenever he finally stops fighting with Matthew Broderick and he says the speech about how, like, I met Maggie when I was in France. Like, you're right. I didn't love her at the time. I thought maybe I would grow to love her. And, like, that was stupid of me to, like, come with her and think that I could learn to love her. But I'd love this other woman now. Yeah. And someone's like, oh, like, again, you're destroying a real human here. This is, like, a real human whose life has just been ruined by your insanity.
Which makes what clearly the movie wants to be a satisfying takedown just becomes like a, ooh, have we all gotten too dark here together?
Yeah.
Like, have we all gotten too deep into this?
Right. I mean, it's one of those things where this could almost sort of be taken as like an anti-rom-com in the sense of like, you know, one of those things where it's like, the behaviors that we see in rom-coms are exaggerated and comical and fictitious, but if you actually did them to a person and someone's life was ruined, like, would you as a character immediately be like, oh boy, I'm not the main character in this story. Like, I am but one human being in the universe. Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, there, like we said, there are definitely aspects of this movie that feel more conventional and straightforward rom-com. But I think almost everything that Meg Ryan and Matthew Broderick are trying to do to Anton to destroy his life veers into sort of over-the-top black comedy, almost parody territory. Like, the fact that they get a monkey to wear a lipstick and then have the monkey kiss him so that his collar will have lipstick so that he has to go home and tell Kelly Preston, like, there's lipstick on my collar, but it's because a monkey kissed me. And then they have a plan to put perfume and squirt guns and have kids...
and have kids
squirt Anton with perfume so that when he comes back home, he'll be like, oh, like, some kids sprayed me with perfume. It's not some other woman's perfume. They sprayed me with it. So that Kelly Preston will eventually be like, you have a lot of weird-ass stories explaining what this perfume and ladies' underwear and all this shit is. Those are the moments where it almost feels like a Mean Girls-style thing of, like, trying to destroy Regina George's life.
But Mean Girls was aware that that was...
Right, and Mean Girls, again, has a heightened tone throughout. It's not that these characters it's not these characters can't be realistic and have actual, like, wants and desires, but they realize that this is sort of an absurd situation, which I wish this movie had a stronger sense of. And, like, again, there are actual funny moments. There are funny parts of this movie. Like, I like that she has her dad always show up and break up with her boyfriends. Yeah. I love that when Matthew Broderick is leaving in the first scene, when the dad shows up with the Dear John letter, as Matthew Broderick's running out the door, the dad's like, hey, wait, I didn't get to the good part yet. So he's like, wait, slow down, I'm not done.
I also like that he interrupts...
with commentary.
At one point he's like, I'm sorry, I can't help it, I'm just like this. She's right, kid.
Yeah, her dad is like, boy, she really is a little crazy here.
I love that as soon as he starts reading the letter, Matthew Broderick charges upstairs to go, like, get his things. The dad raises his voice so he can still hear him reading the letter from downstairs. That was a good bit. It's not, I mean, this is going to what you're saying, though. Like, that... on paper is funny. There are aspects of it in execution that are funny, but the whole thing doesn't feel, like, comedic enough.
Right. It just,
it's not raised up enough.
Right. There's, like, an exaggerated tone that's just not being hit here. And I think it's a little bit of writing, it's a little bit of performance, but it's mostly direction, I think. It's a lot of fault of the director, I think, at the end of the day here.
Anton's character is not... it's not right. Like, it's not leaning into, like, cad asshole douchebag enough. And then it veers too hard into, like, sort of sympathetic broken man.
Right.
So he had to be, like, more extreme overall.
Right. I think it's like you need to pick a lane for him. He can either be, like, a sweetie whose life is genuinely being destroyed by these lunatics, or he can be, like, a fucking garbage man who deserves to have his life ruined.
He's kind of, like... half-ass versions of both.
Sometimes he is genuinely... not, like, he gives Matthew Broderick a job, and he's like, I was homeless once, too. I understand what it's like. And it's like, that's a very decent thing to do. And then it's also like, but I am also fucking this lady on the side. What are you gonna do?
Well, and it's interesting, though, that it's not like he is a folk... I mean, I'm not trying to defend him or anything, but he's not as much of a cad as maybe he should be. Because he has very, like, shitty defenses of, like, I barely even came or whatever, but...
Yeah.
It seems like he only slept with this woman once. It's not like he's been having an ongoing affair. I do kind of like that as the twist.
That like, there actually was an affair this time.
That there actually was an affair, right. But I agree. It's like he's really middle of the road. So then you can neither hate him enough, and then when he is really pathetic, you just feel awkward for having gotten this far.
Yeah. I think that's mostly it.
And, Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just like, what you said, basically. When you see this man have a breakdown, it's a little bit like, oh, man.
Yeah.
Like, boy, this guy is, like, fucked. Like, this poor bastard. He has no money. His credit card bill is run up by Meg Ryan. He doesn't have a job. He doesn't have his restaurant.
His, like, credit card breakdown was the one that really got me. Because that just seems terrifying to wake up and you're, like...
Your credit rating has been destroyed. You owe so much in debt. And just, like, he's wearing a full upper body cast. Yes. And he's just, like, miserable and alone and covered in rashes. And he just found out, like, this one guy who he thought was his friend has been like manipulating him this entire time, and his ex has been trying to make his life miserable. It's just like this poor son of a bitch. Like, even if he is kind of skeezy, by that point I'm just kind of like, God, like, you really have gone too far with this guy. And again, I think the movie kind of realizes it, because like Meg Ryan comes in after that point is like, say that we're even and like we'll stop all this now. But it is like, nonetheless, no amount of coming in and scratching his chin can make up for the fact that you destroyed his credit rating and his source of income.
There is a line he had in Breakdown where he goes, if I can just find my other shoe, everything will be okay. And I was like, oof.
That is one of those ruins of like someone clinging to something as their life is falling apart.
That's tough. It's like tough to watch. And I get it's supposed to be a dark comedy and everything, but that was too much dark, not enough comedy.
Yeah, I agree.
And by the same token, like we talked about, is it Linda?
Yes.
Like, she, like, we not having much of a character.
Yeah, right. Linda's nothing.
And that is also, that's a mistake.
I agree.
Yes.
Like, but there should have been something with her as well. This isn't part of my fix, but I'll save it for fix talk anyway. I think it's better to save for fix talk. But the idea that, like, if there's going to be something abhorrent of the whole time about Anton, then I think if this is a black comedy, then the same should be true about Linda.
I agree.
It should be that Matthew Broderick and Meg Ryan are two people who have been with horrible people and should be thrilled to be broken up with them.
Yes.
But, like, can't let go of it. Like,
right. I mean, it would be almost something if Matthew Broderick was viewing her through rose-tinted glasses the entire time. He's like, we have a perfect relationship. I tilt my telescope down and look at her every day. And it's just, it's one of those moments where it's just like, if you like flash back and realize that like every time he does that, she's like, oh my fucking God. Like, hi Matthew Broderick, nice to see you. And it's just one of those things where it's like, as soon as she saw this opportunity to go to New York, she was like, well, I'm off.
I was thinking about that. It was like, if you were with someone who was like, every day at noon, I'm going to point my telescope at you and I just want you to wave back. I've been like, it's been so nice getting to know you.
I mean, that feels like one of the things, again, where one of the things is closest to a black comedy moment. This is something that I would kind of expect to see in a dumb rom-com where a character literally points like the observatory telescope at their love interest, like, this is cute, hello.
I would even argue the tone at that point in the movie kind of is where it should be, because
this is a legit question. Sorry.
Yes. Yeah.
Do they go down? Do they point down?
Yes.
Yeah.
You can point them.
I mean, you can point them a little bit. Like, there is definitely like, if she is down low enough, it's going to be hard to do.
I doubt that you could get them because it looks like they're on some kind of like village green or something.
I don't think logistically speaking, as it is in this movie, that could have worked. But I think in theory, it could have worked.
I'm thinking of like, it's always a domed roof and I'm
right.
Like,
and it's always pointed.
Window.
Yeah, for obvious reasons, it's pointed up at the sky, which is where you want telescopes to go.
But the whole scene of that opening, the whole tone of that opening scene feels the silliest and most unreal that the movie feels the whole time. And I actually think they should have stayed in that pocket. Just getting back to, what is her name?
Linda.
Thank you. I feel like they were nodding towards something a little bit. So what occurred to me when he meets back up with her in New York and she's like,
I got a tongue stud
and whatever else. Are we meant to believe that when she was in Ohio, right?
Small town.
She had not really discovered a lot of things in life, was maybe sheltered, kind of underexposed to things. And now she's in New York and she's just like, I'm trying all this different shit, good, bad, or indifferent. I'm taking up smoking. I pierce my tongue. So, and I think there are elements of like, I'm borrowing from a boyfriend or whatever, but I felt like for the briefest of moments, there was a hint of like, oh, maybe this character is just trying to try different things, become something new.
Well, I kind of feel like that because you have the whole thing where like Matthew Broderick is listening to them having sex and he's like,
yes.
They're like having sex loudly and passionately. He's like, no, she hates that. She likes it when sex is
quiet
and bland.
Gentle.
Yes. And it's just one of those things where it does feel like, okay, so this movie is suggesting then, like my response at that point is like, yes, this movie is suggesting that her character had sort of had like a one-note repressed boring existence and she
got sick of that, decided to move to the city and found like a whole new aspect of herself. But as soon as Matthew Broderick shows up again, she like almost immediately reverts back to her small town persona, where she like seems embarrassed that she has a tongue set piercing. Yeah. And also like she's still dressing the same. You know, it would feel like it would be a little bit different if she was dressing a little more radically or wild or like provocative or anything.
Had like a mohawk or something.
Or like, you don't even need to go like nuts, but just like if something was different. But she's like looks the same, except that she has a tongue stud. So it's kind of like, she's kind of
and
finding
she's
new, right, and she's smoking.
So I'll say it here then. It's not really part of my fix anyway. Yeah. I think it would have made sense for her thing to have been that she's just sort of like a mirror for the people that she meets and the guys that she dates.
Yeah.
And so like,
because that's also a real person. Like, people do that.
Yeah.
And so like that the reason why, you know, Matthew Broderick's character liked her so much is because like she was adopting his
his
lifestyle.
Bland, boring small town life. Yeah.
And then she goes to, and then it, like her like. So her problem is that she just doesn't have, like, she doesn't really assert her own taste.
Right.
She doesn't, like, have it. She's never really bothered to figure herself out.
And then it feels like Contreras then that, like, her ending should be she has to go find herself as opposed to, no, get back with Anton. It's okay.
Yeah.
I think, if I could be so bold as to name what I think maybe one of the larger themes of this movie, it's both literally and figuratively projection. He is literally projecting this camera obscura image to spy on them. But he has projected a tremendous amount onto her. They kind of hint Meg Ryan has done the same in the past with Anton. You just get the feeling that these two people are going nuts because their projections that they put onto these people were so undeniably challenged, if not completely defeated.
Right.
And to whatever extent Matthew Broderick and Meg Ryan both began folding that projection into their own personal identities probably is what made them both just go completely nuts. Because I can't imagine Meg Ryan was this weird herb ex ninja before Anton broke up with her.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Riding on a motorbike, dressing as Aaron Insurance.
Well, and like, kicking in a skylight.
Breaking skylights and entering.
Has like a rope to rappel down and then has like a bulb on a thing. Like, she comes, and I don't feel like it's ever completely explained, but she comes in as if she has gone out and, like, gathered, like, cat burglar tools.
Right, I mean, he calls her Catwoman at one point. It's like, yeah, she is really, it's like she saw Batman Returns and was like, there it is.
And I do, by the way, think that that's a really interesting idea to explore, even in a dark comedy, because that cycle of projection and how toxic that can become, that's super real. And I think to send that up would have been very effective. I think it's invoked. I don't know how much of that we, like, really get there in this movie.
I think part of the issue is that you don't really know who Meg Ryan was prior to this relationship, which almost feels like if Nana has to show up at the end of the movie, maybe that's the moment where Nana pipes in and is like, boy, like, you sure are weird now, Meg Ryan. Like, you used to be, like, one person, and now it feels like you're going another direction. And the other problem is, again, we still don't know who the fuck Kelly Preston is as a character, so we can't really say they're projecting things onto her, because it's like, I don't know, are they projecting things onto her? Or is this who Kelly Preston actually is? I could not tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do we have stuff about the Tony thing we can talk about?
I think the only thing is I just want to throw out is, like, I wish I had a better sense of explaining, like, what specifically is wrong with the direction of this movie to tell you why the tone doesn't work. Like, and I wish there was just, like, sort of one aesthetic choice or something I could point to. But I think, again, the fact that it doesn't feel as exaggerated as it should.
No.
It feels like it's shot relatively straightforward. You know, there's not a whole lot of creativity going here, which, again, it just feels like Griffin Dunne was a first-time director when he did this movie. A black comedy is a hard tone to strike. So it feels like maybe for your first time out, you do something a little bit more basic to get your feet wet and sort of, like, build up your sense of visual storytelling and then try and do something a little more ambitious. I don't know.
I think there was an attempt to at least try to, obviously, the tone shifts from beginning to end, but because in the beginning, it's very, like, sweet and brightly lit and idyllic. And then once we hit New York, it's shadowy and grimy and feels dangerous and sort of jittery.
Right, there
and paranoid.
Is that, certainly, yeah.
So that is fine. But I think, to your point, though, if you're covering that with a very conventional, you know, camera style and camera work, you're not selling the high style that's needed to really sell this. And then I would also argue he should have really worked with a lot of these. I think Broderick and Meg Ryan are fine, but a lot of the other people needed to deliver their lines differently. There needed to be more of a heightened quality to the way that they were doing this. They all kind of needed to be on the same heightened reality page. And there are moments where it gets there, but I think in general, he was treating this too conventionally. And so even though textually it is dark and comedic, the way that it's delivered both in lines and then visually, like, thwart most of that.
I would argue, I don't think it's, like, one magical thing that ruins it. I think that it's just, like, problems from toe to tip.
Right, yes. No, it's death by paper cuts.
There's, like, problems with the writing, again, because some characters are at a base level written sympathetic when they shouldn't be,
yeah,
or not sympathetic when they need to be. Some of the performances, like, again, we talked about Jackie Cario just being too authentically broken,
yes,
by the end.
Yes.
And, you know, like, Linda's a writing problem. Like, I don't know what they were doing with that character.
Right.
I think that they should do something with her. I mean, I think that the issues of how it looks and stuff were not problematic in and of themselves. I think, like, if it's a black comedy, it still makes sense for the beginning to look idyllic. Because,
yes. Oh, yeah.
Like,
no, I agree. Yeah,
yeah, and it makes sense for New York to look grimy and real.
Right. I think it's just one of the things where, like, I wish New York was, like, a little bit more bizarre almost, you know? Like, a little bit more, like, gross and weird. I know, obviously, he has, like, cockroaches in the box and shit. But
yeah.
I feel like you could have, like, pushed this just a little bit more. And maybe, again, that's one of those things where, like, as a first-time director, you don't feel comfortable really going that broad or big or over the top.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think that, like, certain things... I think probably playing up the charts would have been... better.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a good touch.
No, I love that he's like the smile. Yeah, he's tracking like how big her smile is.
Mutual contacts.
Yes. Like how often they're feeding each other.
Yeah.
Like when they fight or when something happens. It is like he just has like these charts and graphs all over the apartment tracking these things.
It really just exists for like an initial conversation with Meg Ryan, and then they forget about the charts.
Yeah.
And I wish that they had, like it should have been toe-to-tip charts.
I agree. I kind of would love the idea if, like, Matthew Broderick was actually onto something with this,
yes,
and it was somehow help, like, informing what they were doing.
Yeah.
Well, and...
Or for his plans from start to finish to be ruled by charts,
yeah,
because of his, like, astronomy
background. Yes.
Especially,
yes,
since, arguably, that's why Meg Ryan and Matthew Broderick connect, is because they're both so fucking obsessive.
Right, but then as soon as Meg Ryan shows that Matthew Broderick's like, alright, we'll just do it your way. Like, whatever,
yeah,
you feel like doing, we'll just go along with,
yeah,
it.
I also just wonder, this is my last just comment about the direction, I think. Maybe Griffin Dunne just didn't feel confident enough to give people strong enough direction on their performances.
Yeah, I mean, again,
and
early
then,
director.
Within that context makes sense why Broderick and Ryan are maybe probably the closest to correct in their performances. Correct, but the closest to successful in their performances, just because they're already, like, really big, established, great actors by that point. They,
yeah,
don't necessarily need the guidance.
Yeah.
Just the rest of that movie doesn't match their energy.
I had a note here to talk about something that I don't exactly recall what the,
yeah,
name was. I'm just going to say it.
Yeah.
And we'll see
what
happens.
We had a note to talk about rom-com tropes.
Yeah,
oh,
I just,
yeah,
briefly,
this
I think
movie?
Just briefly comment.
Wait, yeah, you lead it there.
Yeah, I think it's just the idea that, you know, it's one of those things where so many actions in a rom-com devoid of all context and devoid of a fictional reality immediately read as psychotic.
Yeah, well,
or,
yeah. If someone,
like,
chases
we
you
know
to the airport,
this, right,
that's weird.
Right, no, and like we all know, this is like nothing new that we're saying here. So it's just one of those, this movie is by and large treating actions that are a little more elevated than your standard rom-com as like straight up evil or manipulative, you know? Whereas in a normal rom-com, it's one of those things where, like, yes, if you stalk your ex, it might be considered cute, or an attempt to get her back, that they will eventually see you and be like, you've been following me all this time,
mm-hmm,
like, you must love me, and
mm-hmm,
have a moment, you know. Again, they're obviously elevated a little bit, like putting cockroaches in his restaurant is like a little more heightened than just showing up with a boombox outside,
yeah,
your ex's house.
What about smashing up moldy strawberries and putting them under your pillow?
No, I think I saw Meg Ryan do that in another movie, actually. Doesn't she do that in Sleepless in Seattle?
Yeah,
she takes,
like,
aboard his houseboat, and yeah,
I mean, we joked about, like, you joked about this movie, Chris, being like, what if a rom-com had stalking? And I was like, well, that is all rom-coms.
Right. I think,
yes,
yeah, I think it's kind of like that. Where
I
it's
guess
just,
what I was getting at when I said that is...
We know, I know what you're getting.
Rom-coms,
yeah,
are not aware, or at least,
no,
they are papering over that much more effectively than this movie is.
Right. And I think the loophole that this movie has, though, is, again, the movie is trying to be a black comedy.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it knows, yes, this is a bad thing that they're doing.
Anything else with rom-com tropes, or was that kind of...
I think that was just...
on the idea that, like, we know we're not... Obviously, rom-coms have things that are just not chill in real life.
Right.
I will say, maybe this was a studio note as well, but like we were intimating before, the movie kind of just leans into real rom-com elements and seems to kind of stop goofing on them at a certain point.
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
And
yeah, for sure.
I would say that's roughly when Nan shows up, and
yes,
we're meant to feel very warm fuzzy about the pictures and the kissing and all that.
Yeah.
I kind of wish we had maybe just stayed on that other track.
If we want to talk about, like, where, you know, where it gets warm and fuzzy, where it doesn't, there's like a really weird and uncomfy scene towards the middle where, like, they have to sneak into...
Okay, I was hoping you would say this.
Yes. Their exes, their shared exes, like,
apartment. Yeah.
Right. This
and,
was
like,
so weird.
They all start, like, cosplaying as their
as like
the new partner.
Right. Yeah. So Matthew Broderick is dressing like up as Anton.
Yeah.
And Meg Ryan puts on one of Kelly Preston's dresses.
And at first they're just kind of like goofing off.
Right. They're like, and Matthew Broderick's like, oh, look at me. I'm such a, like a pompous Frenchman.
They're getting physically close because Meg Ryan found a picture taken of a framed picture of Kelly Preston and what's his face. And they're kind of putting their faces together in the same way.
Right. Like, it's like a selfie picture and they're sort of like positioning themselves.
But they're like very clearly like almost kissing.
Right.
And they actually just start fully making out and you're like.
And then they have sex.
Yeah. And then they sleep in
the bed. In the apartment,
and they call each other by their ex's names.
Yeah.
He says, I love you, Linda. And she goes, I hate you, Anton. And you're just like, oh.
Again, in like a smarter, darker movie, this would be a moment to like realize, oh boy, we have some. And like,
I don't even think. And this is the one scene where I'm like, this doesn't belong in a rom com or a black comedy.
Mm.
This is just like a creepy movie now.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what. Like, I think if it were consistently dark, you could have that in there. But I think the problem is that the next day, Matthew Broderick is like, Meg Ryan, we have to talk about this, and she's like, no, we don't. We're done. We're good. No need to discuss. Let's move on. If they had both woken up and were both just kind of like, oh boy. Like, we really sort of, like, fucked up here a little bit. But Meg Ryan is just so much like, no, this is no more discussion about this. It's weird. We're moving on.
Well, because this movie wants to have it both ways. It wants to be an anti-rom-com that transforms into a rom-com by the end.
Yeah.
So that's supposed to be the moment where these two people realize they like each other. But Meg Ryan's going to put it off because she's too guarded and angry.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely a way you could play this where it is just two complete sickos pretending to be the other person's ex so that they can have, like, a weird night of, like, exercising their sexual fantasies
then,
against their ex.
To Lee's point, I feel like you can only go so far with that before it just becomes a creepy movie. That
right.
No
and then, then again, like, the next day, Matthew Broderick is like, hey, I recognize that we did something weird here. Let's speak on that.
That's like a scene out of one of Chris's, like, sex thrillers.
Yes. Oh,
yes.
Completely.
Yes.
Completely. Yeah. From, like, the 80s or 90s or something. Yeah.
You start in a weird place where Matthew Broderick's character is like this sort of nice suburban guy who like doesn't really want to cause harm and is sort of reluctantly doing this, just wants to get his fiance back.
Right.
And Meg Ryan just starts at like 11.
Yes.
With like, I'm going to ruin this man's life.
Yes.
It just doesn't make for, it kind of ruins these like scenes because he has to react in his sort of milquetoast way.
Yep.
She has to react in her batshit insane way.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not great.
No, I mean, that I think also like goes against them getting together at the end, where it's just sort of like she's been at a crazy level almost the entire movie, and he's been at a boring, angry, pissed off little man level the entire movie. So how could the two of you ever function as a couple without Nana there to photograph you?
What if I told you I have a new movie in the works, and it's a 10 years later sequel?
I'd say, where did you get funding?
These two
stuff. Oh my God.
Who gave you the funding for this, Chris, is what I would say.
If these two get together and, like, let's say, like, we're for some reason in, like, their lives, like, we just know them as people. Wouldn't we just be like, are they just going to, like, eat each other alive? Like, what the fuck is going to happen between these two whack-jobs?
No, I think it's more of, like, a sort of praying mantis situation where my guy
will, like, devour Matthew Broderick one day, yes.
They have children?
Yes, exactly.
Literally take his head off.
Yeah.
Right, where Matthew Broderick, they go to have, like, sex for the first time. Matthew Broderick's like, sex is boring and unpleasant, right? And Meg Ryan's like, I'm sorry, what now?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Meg Ryan's character in this movie suffers from...
Are we just going to get into Kerax?
I guess we could get into Kerax.
Might characters. As well, yeah.
She suffers from that sort of, like, late 90s, 2000s tough girl...
Yeah,
very much, yes.
...aspect, but, like, it's kind of egregious here the way that there's, like, not... Like, you get no sense of, like, where her brittleness comes from.
Oh, right.
She's obviously stung by this breakup, but, like, we pointed out when we were watching this that in order for her to have gotten in that situation, like, where she's Meg Ryan, she looks like Meg Ryan, and she got sort of fooled by this guy looking for, like, just a visa, quote-unquote, which we're a little confused about.
Right.
But she was used by a man... who could have used a lot of other people a lot easier. So she must have been in some sort of weird emotionally susceptible place or vulnerable place before then. But we don't know
anything. It's one of those things where there's clearly something broken about this character, but we never do the work to figure out like how or why.
And because we never get a clear answer, it's either she was always this crazy and this is a new level activated by the breakup, or she was fine and then the breakup happened and she just went bug nuts insane. That part is hard to grasp. I almost think there's elements of like... She's almost like a dark manic pixie dream girl.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Like,
the mega manic pixie.
Which kind of makes sense to pair that with a Matthew Broderick character who is going to be more like...
Manic demon nightmare girl?
Yes!
Yeah.
Yeah, literally. Who is then just like, he needs this woman full of energy to animate him and give him a mission, basically.
Yeah.
I will say, all of that being said, for me, she's the one who gets, I think, the closest to what this movie could have been.
Mm-hmm.
She seems legitimately like a dangerous person in this movie. Even when she's wearing those stupid goggles. Those, like,
enormous,
like, old-timey, like, motorcycle goggles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think Meg Ryan is pretty great in this. I think she sort of gets the heightened tone, and she's mostly selling the jokes, which don't always work. There's a lot of, like, line deliveries that she has in this movie that I think are very, very funny. And since, you know, one of, like, a couple, like, the few bright moments come from just Meg Ryan's manner of delivering a line for a movie
can
like this.
Call out where, like, right when they're trying to shove Nan on a bus to go home, and she's like, last minute revealing that, like, she's
overheard,
seen this critical piece of information, and, like, they're desperate to get it out of her, and the bus is trying to go, and the driver's like, hey, we gotta go, and she just kind of, in the middle of this, turns around and goes, like a non-verbal grunt of just like, get away from me.
I love that she kind of does that again as one of the reactions when Broderick is in the apartment with Anton, and you just hear across,
hear, like, screaming.
It's always normally a grunt, but that's, like, a Meg Ryan quirk to just sort of do these, like, sort of physical flinches. Like, back into the side, like, sort of like a shoulder turn.
Rotate.
Just, like, I mean, a dismissive sort of, like,
She kind of gives us a little taste of that in Kate and Leopold, and she's like, can you just go?
She does it a lot in French Kiss.
Yeah.
But it's not always done in frustration, it's done in an excitement.
I mean, Big Rain's great. What can we say?
She's great, America's sweetheart.
She has great physicality. It's deployed well here.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. I the problem really still is, who is this woman? Similar to Kelly Preston, who has literally nothing to play, Meg Ryan at least has an emotion to play. Right. You know, like, her emotion is retribution and rage. But again, we don't really know what Meg Ryan's deal is. We don't know who she was prior to this. It's just sort of like she, you know, sprung forth fully formed one day as Anton, like, raged, and she just, like, was summoned into existence. But it's just like, I wish there was something more for Meg Ryan to play in this movie. Like, there are moments where she acts genuine. Like, as much as I think that like gross monologue she has about the dog, about how she had a dog that had, I don't understand biology, so I'm not going to say that this is inaccurate, but, like, a dog and flies, a fly laid eggs in the dog's anus, and the maggots were going to hatch and devour the dog from the inside. Like, is that a thing that could happen?
I don't know.
Like, surely you could give the dog something to kill?
It's fucking terrifying sounding.
Yeah,
though.
And it's deeply upsetting. And then she also talks about how, and my dad didn't want to put the dog down, and so he took the dog home and, like, used his finger and scraped out every one of those maggots over the course of one night. That's what love is, Matthew Broderick. And that's, like, clearly this is some sort of genuine feeling of emotion that Meg Ryan is having for this, and she's sort of playing it, like, even though it's a disgusting monologue, she's playing it very straight, as love is gross and weird and unattractive. It's not all sort of waving at your sweetie from your telescope miles away. Sometimes it's doing disgusting things for the person you love. And that's, like, one of those moments where, like, okay, like, there's something a little bit more to this character, you
and
know?
And then to put a clear button on it, she takes a bite out of a hot dog and gets mustard
on her face.
Yeah.
Yes. That speech is disgusting.
Yeah.
But I wish there were more things to that effect to sort of explain a little bit more about who she is and where she was coming from.
One of the causes of the problems with her character is that the movie kind of exclusively takes place from Matthew Broderick's perspective.
Yes, that's true.
So, like, we start with him and we learn about it, and then we meet Meg Ryan through his perspective, and she literally says no words for the first, like, 3 minutes of her appearance. Because her character is incredibly emotionally closed off and just sort of repressed or shut in, like, she's hiding her emotions, she doesn't fucking say anything about
it. Right.
We don't learn.
Right.
There's no window for us to learn more about her backstory.
Right. Again, if Nana shows up, then you think that, like, that's the time where you find out more about Meg Ryan. Like, the only purpose that Nana can possibly have in this movie, aside from doing an info dump that could have been found out any other way, is that you use her to find out, like, what Meg Ryan's deal is.
Or Jackie Cario could tell us something we didn't know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, his little speech at the end where he talks about, like, how he didn't really love her. Tell us a little bit about what she was like before then. But no, we don't get
that. But it is, like, a big problem that we don't know her character that well.
Yeah.
But Meg Ryan does amazing work with what we got.
Yeah, no, I think she still brings it.
I guess we'll go to Matthew Broderick.
Maddie Broads.
Maddie Bro.
Sam / Mike.
He also, Matthew Broderick channels this like freakish, especially once he gets to New York, this like feral energy.
Right. Yeah. So there's, I think,
a thing that he parlays into his future career very well, he's displaying here, right? Where he like is transitioning from like, I used to be a heartthrob and I'm a weird guy.
Right. Like I used to be a cool kid and now I'm sort of transitioning to a sad sack man.
Yes.
And so like, this is really a fascinating time in his career because this is around the same time as the movie Election, which also very effectively utilizes the weird crossroads that Matthew Broderick was in. Is like, he's still kind of cool, but he also is coming off as kind of this sad put upon man who doesn't realize how like shitty he actually is.
Yeah.
And like, that's a movie that very effectively utilizes his persona and, you know, gives him a great script and great direction to work with.
Yeah.
And this is kind of doing that too. So like, I think in many respects, Matthew Broderick is kind of great casting for this character. Like, he's just so in between playing like a nice guy and someone who's shitty and never learns how shitty they are. And like, it's kind of a great moment for him to be portraying this. It doesn't work, but like, I see why you would cast Matthew Broderick in this role. This is kind of where he was at this moment.
Absolutely. And I'm sure similar to Meg Ryan, they were both into like really doubling down in a much weirder, freakier direction than really their careers at that point had really been.
Right. I mean, it almost seems like for Meg Ryan, like, this is just like one of those like women in Hollywood thing where it's like, okay, you're a cutie and you're in all the rom-coms and now you're going to turn 40 soon. So like, what are we going to do with you now? It's one of those things where like women kind of have to be like, okay, like, can I do other things? Will you let me play other characters? Or are you just going to be like, well, you'd be in a rom-com, but you're 39 now. And I don't know if men will turn out to see that. So it's just, it's kind of feels like Meg Ryan is trying to, at this point, see like what else she can sort of get out there. And I think she's doing it well. I think Matthew Broderick kind of realized that his persona from this point on was going to be wet sock and like kind of just transitioned to playing that all the time, which is kind of a bummer because it's his least interesting persona, I think.
Yeah.
Just Matthew Broderick being kind of a drip. I guess it works for the producers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think he's bad in this. I think he's not quite as keyed in as Meg Ryan is. And maybe that's just because, again, at least Meg Ryan has some over-the-top stuff to play. Most of his behavior is just agree with what Meg Ryan wants to do. So maybe that doesn't really help him any. But he's not bad in this. No, I think he could have been very good in this.
It's kind of his job to be more subdued. He's kind of playing like straight man to crazy lady.
Right.
Yes.
Because he's the one who has to come in at the end and be like, Meg Ryan, you're going too crazy with all this. We have to stop this sort of
shit. Tone it down.
Yes.
You've gone too far. God bless that movie.
Yeah,
it's
truly.
Give us so much.
Southland Tales. The gift that keeps on giving.
Cheikh Ikaria, I guess. Anton.
I think he's miscast.
Here's the thing, and I went on an IMDb hunt when I was in my high school years for him.
Mm-hmm.
He's not like a hot European.
Right. No, I think that's a big part of it, too.
Average looking.
Right, he's not like
distinct.
Bad looking, but he's not like someone you would walk by on the street and be like, oh my, who's
this?
Right,
he needs to be more, especially for what they're going for in terms of him just being this like, he has a big dick.
When they talk about like, he used to be a model and all this shit too, and it's one of those things like, this guy does not look like that guy.
No.
Right. And again, the writing for this character is bizarre because, again, he's like asked to go from sort of like comic buffoon to tragic man whose life has just been destroyed. And he plays that very well. I don't think he's bad in this movie. I just think he is not who should have been cast in this part.
I agree.
Yeah, he doesn't quite look the part of the kind of character they want him to be. And yeah, I can't really blame the acting because I think that probably he was being told to do.
Right. It's a fault of direction and writing more than his performance. I'm sure he's doing precisely what he was asked to do.
But he does put in good performances for the different scenes that he's in.
Yes.
Where he's supposed to be A, an asshole, and B, a sad, broken man.
Yeah, and he's funny in
he's
those
also
scenes.
Comedic.
Yeah,
he's pretty good at being a comedic actor as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, he just doesn't read as like somebody that you would break up with your boyfriend for and find to be like this hot European French and somebody who can make a speech about being Superman and how women you make women wet just by walking in a room or something.
Oh my god, yeah. Well, I actually did that kind of think that was funny, right, for him to be like, yeah, in France, I'm just, like, very normal, but over here, everyone thinks I'm hot shit.
Right,
yeah.
Which, I mean, again, also, I guess maybe that could be saying something about his character and Kelly Preston's character, where it's the fact, like, yeah, when you think about it, this guy isn't that hot, but it's just sort of, like, because he's French, he seems exotic to you. But then I think that's at odds with the whole, like, his dick is huge, and, like, he was a former model, and, like, that's one of those things where, like, well, no, he kind of must be, like, he is supposed to be, like, that hot and cool.
What is it that he says when you were saying that, like, women get wet from or whatever, there's like an image he uses.
Like it's like a morning daisy,
wet
or
like a
shit.
Spring daisy.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like a
morning
daisy.
Yeah.
Like, it's not
Christ.
A good line.
Oof.
No, and that's also one of those moments where it's like, now we've gone beyond being like charming
being,
European to being gross.
Well, yeah, like, well, again, we were supposed to maybe think he was a cad, and he is kind of a cad, but that line is like way beyond that. That line is like, Now I put you in the same room. That's like
you're like a men's rights activist
grabbing him by the pussy.
Yeah, exactly. God, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Right. Because I do think like there is something to be said about, like we said while watching this, it's like the call in Love Actually, where it's like you are a guy from another country and you realize because you are from another country and you have an accent that automatically like gives you something that certain people will respond to and be like, how exotic it is that I'm dating a Frenchman or something. You know, that is something right there.
I will say I do think it's a little deflating that he and Linda just get back together. Like, this all happens and then we're just reset back to one, basically.
I mean,
I guess part of it, again, is because, let's talk about Linda. Who the fuck is she?
Yeah, that's the biggest thing.
The fuck is she?
I think by the time they get back together, you are meant to believe from the movie that he is genuinely in love with her, because he has that scene at the end where he says, like, I didn't love Meg Ryan, but I do really love Linda. And so you are, I think, supposed to leave this movie being like, oh, he's telling the truth. He does really love Linda. But again, who the fuck is Linda throughout all this?
Yeah, who is Linda? And why do we care that she gets back together
with her? She's like a MacGuffin, basically.
Yeah, I mean,
she is like an object for Matthew Broderick to retrieve.
Right.
It would be something else if, again, during that conversation he has with Matthew Broderick at the end, where he was saying things about, also how you had said earlier, like he could be saying things about Meg Ryan that Matthew Broderick didn't know. He could be saying things about Kelly Preston that Matthew Broderick didn't know. He's like, do you know that like she loves X, Y, and Z? Matthew Broderick was like, well, no, that never came up before. And he's like,
I mean, it's like, this is a 30-something teacher, and she acts like she's like a college girl in spring break.
Yes, absolutely.
Champagne.
The tongue stud. I know we can get back to that.
Definitely.
Thing
to be doing. It's also just like, it's so wild to think that she takes these elementary school children to a playground. And then she's like, all right, I'll be right back. I gotta have a smoke with my ex-boyfriend.
Right, yeah. My assistant can sit here and watch the kids for a minute. I'm gonna go have a smoke. See ya.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
In Manhattan.
You'd get fired immediately.
Well, I guess they must need teachers probably in public school system in New York.
Yeah.
So, I just wish there was, like, anything to this character, you know?
Even if they had just decided to make her, like, super uber-duber Pollyanna, that would be one
thing. Yeah.
But it's neither nor. She just is.
Yep.
Like, there are hints that point at a potential character, but they don't congeal into one, right?
Right,
like,
yeah.
And that's the writing, really.
Yeah.
Mostly the writing.
Yeah, I can't really blame Kelly Preston. Again, it's you're right, she's trying. I'm sure she's trying as much as she can to,
What does she get into do, though, aside from just react to shit? Because, I mean, like, the most interesting things about her almost have nothing to do with Kelly Preston's performance.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Sending your dad to read a breakup letter. That's a wild thing.
Right, and that also feels so different from, like, the sort of buttoned-up school teacher that we see. You know, so it's sort of like, she's a buttoned-up school teacher, but she can't break up with a man and will send her father to do her dirty work. And her father, who says, like, my daughter's crazy, will do this for you. She will also get a tongue stud, but then seem to kind of regret the fact that she got a tongue stud.
She seems very sheepish when she's showing it to Matthew Broderick.
Yeah.
But, I mean, to Lee's point, she could just, well, now this guy's in front of me, and as the mirror, I feel weird about this now.
Right.
Because this is an aspect of that identity that doesn't jive with him.
Right.
I didn't do the math on this, but there's a decent chance that most of her screen time is, like, through that lens, through the projector.
The camera obscura.
Yeah, I think it probably is.
Or through the lens of the telescope.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Yes. I mean, it does almost feel like there could be it's very intense and, like, kind of nuts for your dad to come in and be like, my daughter's crazy. But, like, it almost feels like there is a version of the movie that could kind of play up to that, where it's not that she's, like, literally crazy. It's just that she's like, I really don't fucking know what I'm doing anymore. Like, I've been living in a small town as a teacher for my entire fucking life under the thumb of my weird ass dad. So, like, I don't know how to fucking function as an adult, and I need to figure that out.
I was going to say, not for nothing, but dad didn't say no to her request. So she may be crazy, but kind of seems like maybe he is too.
I'm sure he is. I mean, he's fucking reading these letters god knows how many times.
Having their, like, couple's breakfast at that table.
I love also that Matthew brought it, the day that she's supposed to come back to Smallville or wherever the fuck they are, he is, like, getting someone to hang up a sign across two telephone poles, being like, welcome back, Kelly Preston. And it's just like, Christ, there's nothing going on in this fucking town, is there? If it's literally at the point that you can have people hang up a sign being like, great to see you again after 2 months, and the, like, people in the town will do it, like, boy, like, you guys need to open a Walmart or something.
Pretty much talked about all the characters, right?
Yeah, I mean,
anyone we're missing?
I mean, Nana, but, like, Nana's nothing.
She's not a character.
Nana, a character who I feel like could have very easily been written out and probably should have.
Yeah.
I think she was just a pretense to give us more lovey scenes.
It's a four-hander, this movie.
Sorry, Nana, your hands aren't needed anymore.
All right, I think we wanted to do a little looking to score.
Yeah, I just very briefly wanted to do looking to score because this, and I just want to throw this out, this movie is composed by a woman named Rachel Portman, who is a British composer, and she's kind of a big deal because she's one of the few prominent women composers in a field that's kind of dominated by a lot of men. She won an Academy Award for her score for Emma. She was also nominated for Cider House Rules and Chocolat. Wow. So it's like, this is a woman who does shit, you know? She has done shit. She knows what she's doing. I think the score for this is fucking awful. The score for this feels like it's either for a child's movie or for a conventional rom-com. And I think there's a way you could do a score that's a very conventional rom-com that's using it ironically and winking. Because nothing else works to do that effectively in this movie, the score also feels like it's something that's failing in those moments. Especially at the end when Matthew Broderick comes back to Meg Ryan, he's telling the story about like the Lassie and Timmy movie that he watched. It's a very sort of conventional soaring, you know, end of the movie rom-com score. And that could be done as a joke, as sort of like a winking irony, but because so much of the movie has a lot of over-the-top Mickey Mousing, like,
yes,
of characters, it's like the entire score just feels like it's at this level and is like just an over-the-top score by someone who like didn't get good direction as to what to do, you know?
Do you think it may not have been the composer's idea, or who knows, but I kind of wondered if that was meant to give, to try to will some of the black comedy into existence, like, look how serious this is, or look how like dark and weird this is, but we're playing basically like cartoon music.
It could be, yeah, it could be, but it's just one of those things where like sometimes it's just when like a character is sort of awkwardly climbing around, it's sort of like, you know, it's the sort of score you would expect to see in like Air Bud or something like that if someone was sneaking around a house, you know? It's just sort of this over the top like burp, 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 burp. This is not helping the movie. I think there's definitely a way you could use the score ironically during certain scenes to sort of show that this movie gets that, like, what's going on here is fucked up, and we're commenting on the fact that, like, boy, rom-coms are kind of fucked up sometimes. Am I right, guys? It just feels like her score is constantly, like, Meg Ryan's performance at 11 throughout this movie.
Yeah.
So it's sort of hard to sort of view it in a straightforward or ironic fashion, because it just feels so over the top.
Mm-hmm.
What movie was it, Brendan, that we were watching where we had the joke about the music being like, Snoop, 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 Snoop? Because it was like a bass. It was like a bass plucking a note.
I do remember that, yeah. It's just
was
like,
it for this podcast?
Snoop, Snoop, Snoop. No, it was
pre-podcast. Yeah, I know. I remember exactly what you meant. It is just sort of just like, boop, boop, boop,
yeah,
boop,
it was like somebody
boop,
plucking
boop,
a bass in a sort of jaunty, sneaky fashion.
Right, as a character is like
it
sneaking
was
around.
For somebody
yeah.
sneaking around. And
yes.
we were just,
it just like, Snoop, Snoop.
Well, that's all we got. Let's talk about our fixes. Does anyone want to go first?
I can go first. So this is kind of like the most obvious statement of how to make the movie better, but obviously this needs like a stronger tone throughout. And I think it needs to be a stronger, darker, over-the-top tone throughout the entire movie. So it's just one of those issues where, for me, I think the biggest problem here is the direction. The screenplay is not always great, and there are aspects of that that I'll get to for a minute, but I do think it just needs like a director who had a stronger sense of sort of what a black comedy was. One almost feels like, I don't think this is like an ideal choice, but I feel like Danny DeVito was kind of doing this sort of shit for
a
while.
He was.
So like it almost
like
feels
like Mama from the Train.
Right, yeah. It almost feels like you need someone like a Danny DeVito with that kind of a touch to make this movie work. So that's kind of my idea for who should have done this. Similar to how you have Matthew Broderick and Anton like sort of like bouncing off each other for a while, I think Meg Ryan should try to befriend Kelly Preston in this movie. So that way you can also find out more about both of who the fuck they are and like kind of get a sense for who these characters are. But I think as soon as she finds out that Matthew Broderick is going to work in Anton's restaurant, Meg Ryan is just like, oh, well, I'm going to meet Kelly Preston outside the school, bump into her, and then I'll be like, hey, let's go get drinks, girlfriend, and like have a nice chat, and then try and poison her against Anton, you know? And so then you get to get a little bit more for like who these fucking enigmas of characters are. I think Anton should be like an aggressively sort of Euro trash himbo cool guy who like genuinely thinks that Matthew Broderick is his best friend, is not at all like an asshole to him. He just meets Matthew Broderick and he's like, well, Matthew Broderick's like so fucking cool, right? Like, I fucking love this guy.
He's so neat.
Yeah, right. It's so stupid, but like, you guys never saw the DuckTales reboot, I assume, right? There
parts of it. I didn't watch it all the way through.
There is this one joke where there's like a bird in DuckTales called Storkules, who is the DuckTales equivalent of Hercules. Huey, Dewey, Louie are all like, oh my god, like Storkules, he's so fucking cool. And it turns out when Storkules shows up, he's like, where's my best friend Donald Duck? And Donald Duck is like, oh, I fucking hate this guy. And Storkules is just like, Donald, you're my best friend, I love you. And Donald's like, yeah, okay, sure, whatever. Like, I just want it to be like that, where this, like, big dumb sweetie is just like, we're close friends, and, like, you love me, right? And he's just like,
yeah, sure, we're friends, Anton, fine. It's like, that's kind of the tone that I want to go for there.
Yeah.
Meg Ryan's story about him being with her to get a visa, I think should be something that she just completely made up to justify him breaking up with her. Like, it's something that she concocted in her mind. And this is when Matthew Ruddock starts to realize, like, oh, maybe Meg Ryan is unraveling at this point. I think in real life, Anton probably left her because she just got like, possessive and crazy and weird. And he was like, oh boy, like, this is a bad relationship for me to be in. And she's like, he's leaving me and I got him his visa. And, like, she just makes up the story in her head. Matthew Broderick finds out that Meg Ryan indeed actually literally has been building to killing Anton. Like, she wants to make him suffer and then die in a horrible fashion. And Matthew Broderick's like, whoa now. Okay, like, this has to stop now. Like, it ends kind of, I think, with him, like, foiling an attempt, that, like, an over-the-top attempt that she's making on his life and getting Meg Ryan dragged off to prison, like, cackling and screaming. Broderick realizes that actually in real life, he kind of fucking sucks too, and he's kind of crazy in his own way, and, like, gets into the idea of, like, loving women possessively without actually caring who they are or what they want. He was, like, so blinded by Meg Ryan that he couldn't see that she was mentally unwell, and he, like, had this idea of who Kelly Preston was. I want to do, like, a flashback thing at the end where you do the first scene of them with the telescope, and you realize that Kelly Preston's just like, yes, hi Matthew, hi, nice to see you, like, it's great, it's great that you're looking at me through your telescope every day at noon, I fucking love this, this is a normal thing to do. And realizes that, like, actually Kelly Preston's sort of been, like, stifled and, like, wants to sort of go out into the world and explore and do things, and she's always been telling them, what if we, like, left this small town and, like, did our own shit? Matthew Ruddock's like, why would you leave this small town when you can observe things through a powerful telescope instead? And it's just sort of like
you're, I just want to say, yeah, your impression of Matthew Ruddock in this movie or outside this movie has been unhingedly like Poindexter.
I think this is the same voice, because this is the same voice I used in Stepford Wives when Matthew Broderick was playing.
It's such a huge diss to Matthew Broderick. No, such disrespect.
Hey. He's like a creepy little nerd.
Hey, don't do that.
So I think at the end he gets Anton and Kelly Preston back together because he realizes, like, oh, actually, like, these two kind of genuinely do love each other, and, like, their significant others, myself and Meg Ryan, have been, like, fucking bad news for them. Maybe this is a relationship that can actually flourish. And he gets them back together, takes the credit for everything going on, and realizes, I gotta just get the fuck out of here, figure out who the hell I am, and, like, go off into the world and learn how to not be a creepy little weirdo. And that's my fix.
Right. I like that.
Mine's short.
Go for it.
Like Matthew Broderick.
There's a shot in that movie that really emphasizes how small he is.
Yeah. So many shots fired against Matthew Broderick today, by the way.
Okay, actually, let me just give a good thing. He looks pretty hot in this
movie. Yeah, I think he's pretty attractive in this.
No, he looks good with a little 5 o'clock shadow.
He does, agreed. And I like his hair, multiple angles. He looks great.
Yeah, no, good look.
All right, I'm doing a very different movie. Mm-hmm. I want this movie to be sort of, I want it to sort of have the feel of a Hitchcockian thriller. And it takes place entirely from Linda and Anton's perspective. And it's sort of like one of those movies where, like, the husband is maybe the villain or the killer. But it's that Linda starts to suspect that Anton is cheating on her. And he has, like, these increasingly unbelievable excuses for
why there's makeup on his collar, why he smells like another woman, and
And then she starts to, like, slowly discover, like, weird things around the house, like, you know, there's, like, a glint coming off the opposite window or something, or, like, I want it to be, like, yes, that, like, these two crazy people are stalking them the whole time and have actually concocted this insane plan with, like, these insane ways of making it seem like Anton is having an affair.
Uh-huh.
But really it is just, like, all of his excuses are, in fact, true.
Yes.
So similar to, like, that whatever movie it is where, like, Cary Grant, she thinks that Cary Grant's a killer or whatever, mm-hmm. and you find out that, like, actually he was totally fine. I would be just like that, where it's like, actually, Anton actually does love her, and, like, there is maybe some checkered history with him where he had, like, a woman in the past that he did use, but it's got nothing to do with the fact that he loves her a lot. And it just plays out just like that, but it's like a sort of satirical, parodical, Hitchcockian thriller.
Yeah.
Where we're learning about these insane stalkers at the same time that Linda does.
I kind of love that. I would, honestly, I'd be there for it.
Lee?
Yeah.
I had a very similar fix.
Did you really?
Because
that's insane, because I didn't know going into this what my fix was going to be, and it halfway through watching the movie, I was like, that's what it's going
to
be.
I had a few different ideas bouncing around, but the one I had landed on was, I would love to know what this experience was like from Linda's perspective.
Yeah, true.
Just because what we get in the movie is so heavily strained through Matthew Broderick, I want to know, when Linda's such a mystery as a character, my thought is, Linda is going to be our main character in my fix. I'm thinking we almost play this up like one of the world's most demented Hallmark movies, where it's this, like, hyper-idyllic small town that is not named where it is, similar to this movie. I think you could even potentially, if you wanted to go really wild aesthetically, you could just make this look like Pleasantville almost.
Yeah.
The idea of him looking at her through the telescope was so weird and too, like, so much to me that I was like, okay, what if we took it further? And it's like, this small town is like way over involved in their relationship. And mm-hmm. so they're the ones that are like, you need to get out to that spot. It's almost noon. Yeah. He needs to be able to see you through his yada, yada, yada. And that it's all of that that feels so overbearing and suffocating for her, which is why she takes like the first chance out of that small town. I think she realizes when she gets to New York of like, whoa, I don't really actually know who I am. But I do want, if we're going to have the idea of small town, I want it to be a like hyper weird, aggressive,
Babe kind pig of in the city,
dangerous New York. What I think I want to have happen is Meg Ryan's character mentions, I think exactly once, that she's a photographer and they don't do much with that.
Well, I mean, she is taking photos throughout because she takes the photos of Matthew Broderick. True. So like, you don't see a whole lot of her doing it professionally, but there is a lot of photography happening.
I want to be much clearer of like Anton meets her while maybe he's trying to get away from Meg Ryan, mm-hmm. and Meg Ryan's already like, they're in the same kind of like crazy bohemian artist community together. I think a lot of the same, I had the same idea around the idea of her, like you play it straight of her suspecting that there's an affair, the stories are too ridiculous to be believed, and then finds out, oh no, actually it is.
Yeah.
That demented guy from back home and his crazy ex-girlfriend. And I really want Meg Ryan's character to have at multiple points been in the apartment secretly taking pictures of them. The lifetiminess about it, or I guess this is more lifetimey than Hallmark, but to have there be more of a like heightened soapy tone, I think you needed, especially aesthetically, the lighting needed to be way more dramatic. I think we needed to have people really going for it in terms of their performances. I think we make, similar to what you were saying, we need to make Anton way more of a traditional too good to be true hunk, kind of ripping off this idea of the super safe idyllic suburbs and the like super scary New York City.
Yeah.
I think the thing I thought of just real quickly when I was like, after I finished mine, is that maybe the attempt that Meg Ryan can make to kill Anton is that there's the parts of the movie where she like sneaks into their apartment to like ruffle shit up or whatever, or put strawberries in his pillow, is that she's been secretly like constructing this elaborate mousetrap style death for him in his apartment. It's just one of those things like you don't quite get like why she's stacking books in one place over another throughout the movie, but like she comes in, she moves books, I'm like, okay, whatever it is that she's doing, and she's created this like Rube Goldberg style death trap around, because I want to see this as a deconstruction of the manic pixie dream girl who is like gone over around the bend. Yeah. Basically
my twee murder machine.
Yes,
it revolves around like, it's like a date based thing where it's like she knows something about Anton that he'll open a bottle of
wine. Right, yes. He'll do like one thing at one point
specific date.
Right. Yeah, yes. Yeah. And then like, and she knows like, yes, this is this exact moment, this is when the death will happen. Yes. And Matthew Broderick realizes, like, as he's about to do it, is like, uh oh.
She knows his habits too well.
I think, you know, there's still a good difference there of like, I definitely want it. I was definitely envisioning mine as like a direct parody. It has the feel, like, I was thinking, my thought was that it felt like a Hitchcock premise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like a lighter version of the Hitchcock. There are many Hitchcock premises where it's like
a little bit,
or even
more
like a Hitchcock, but like that sort of gothic romantic thing of like, mm-hmm. I am with someone, and they've now I suspect that they're a horrible evil
right,
man.
Right, right.
And actually, they're just they're
right.
Just
they're Rebecca. You're Rebecca's. Your
yes,
dragon.
Rebecca
lives.
Is exactly yeah. what I was
yeah.
just thinking.
Actually,
of.
They're just sad and have a dark past.
Yeah.
Or something.
I mean, honestly, I feel like you could do your version as a straight up thriller, and
yes.
it would still work too. Like that'd be
yeah.
frankly pretty terrifying in of itself to
yes.
find out your ex has been hiding across the street from you for months
yeah.
and is like secretly conspiring to break
and
you up.
What a wild twist that would be! Just because you're definitely serving up one thing, which is, oh no, my new boyfriend's cheating on me.
Yeah.
But no, I think with the fun part about it being a parody is that it's like such a like low ball version of that. Like it's like
right.
a soft ball version of it.
Right.
Like fun to just play it up as this like, oh no, am I in danger? Except it's like, oh no, is he cheating on me?
Right.
Like, oh no. But yeah, I like those ideas.
Yeah.
From a lot. Good job. Guys,
good
would
job.
Recommend this movie.
I think it's probably a no for me. Like there are definitely some elements that are fun. It's fun seeing Meg Ryan play against type
uh-huh.
in this. But,
and she does well.
No, she does, but I don't know. There's not enough, like, entertainment here for me to really recommend it.
It's a no for me as well. There's so much potential here for this to have been a wild, much, like, crazier, more memorable movie. But as it is in its current form, it just makes me feel uncomfortable. And then there are certain times where I'm like, oh, that's pretty funny. But yeah, overall, I feel kind of uncomfy about this movie.
Yeah.
No, I'm also going to echo no. I think there's just better ways to get your Meg Ryan fix.
Agreed.
Yes.
and the interesting stuff is not worth it.
No.
Yeah.
The hard stuff.
This was one of those ones where I was definitely like, boy, I hope this is kind of a secret masterpiece or something when I started watching it. Like, I hope that was one of those movies where, like, actually everyone's wrong about it. And, like, it kind of works in a weird way. No, not really.
All right. Well, that's a wrap on Addicted to Love.
We have kicked our addiction.
And finally, none of us are addicted to love anymore.
No, thank you.
Come back at us in 2 weeks and we will be back with another mini episode.
Yep.
We'll talk about God knows what.
God knows
It'll
what.
It'll be down to the wire.
Down to the wire.
Christ will let us know what we'll talk about.
Yeah, we will all pray to the Lord.
And we'll know it's Christ because we'll all get the same message.
We'll all get the same message,
Dreadpack.com is the website. That's about it.
Yeah.
And we're on all the podcast apps and platforms and what
have you. Find our podcast. If you're not subscribed, do it.
Yep, great love.
How would we say bye in French? Au revoir! Au revoir!